Hjertelig, hjertelig velkommen til en spesial episode av Aftenpodden USA. Vi live I Lillestrøm på NHOs årskonferanse oppe på mezzaninen eller terrassen over det store lokalet der det hele skjer. Jeg heter Kristoffer Rønneberg, og med meg så har jeg som alltid mine makkere Kjetil Hansen og Kristina Pletten. Hei på dere.
Hei, hei Kristoffer.
Hallo Kristoffer.
Stas å være live?
Ja.
And we have a special guest, so we'll be doing the rest of this podcast in English. James Robinson, you are a political science and a professor at the University of Chicago. You're also a Nobel Prize winning economist. You won the Nobel Peace, not the Nobel Peace Prize, but
not yet.
That might be next year. But you won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2024, and you're the author of the best-selling book Why Nations Fail. We've just heard you talk about some of your ideas here at the conference. We're very happy to have you here to talk some more about current affairs and how they relate to your ideas. So let me start by asking you about Venezuela, because that's on everyone's mind right now. Venezuela used to be a very prosperous state. It's a very energy-rich state. It has a lot of minerals and other natural resources, and it was run in a way that made the country quite prosperous. But then in the past 25 years, we've seen institutions fail. We've seen the economic turning to a halt. I think the GDP is now 20% of what it used to be. Yeah. The fact that the state has been weakened to that extent, or that the society has been weakened to that extent, did that make it easier for the U.S. to do what they did on Saturday when they didn't invade the country, but they removed the head of state from the country?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's good to go back before Chavismo, actually, before the rise of Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez didn't kind of come out of the blue. You know, he rose to power because the previous system was extremely corrupt and clientelistic. The kind of the two big hegemonic parties, you know, COPE and Acción Democrática, were very corrupt. You know, there was a lot of problems already prior to the rise of Chavez. So there's a kind of deep history of, you know, you're right. You know, in some sense, in the 1970s, Venezuela was the one country in Latin America that everybody thought was going to escape, basically, and become like North America. But that was already going off the rails before Chavez came to power. But obviously, you know, there's so much discontent. There's 8 million Venezuelans have been driven out of the country, you know. So you know, many people are desperate for change in Venezuela, clearly.
And Christina, I mean, we're following this very closely now, as yeah. I guess most of our listeners are. If we try to sort of look one step ahead and looking at what Trump might want with not just Venezuela, but with the whole Western Hemisphere, that he's bringing the Monroe Doctrine back to life, or the Donroe Doctrine. What do you see the next step being in this project that he has now started? The Minister of Defense, or the Minister of War, as he likes to call himself, Pete Hegseth, he said, welcome to 2026. And I guess it started with a bang. What's next?
Well, when you ask me what's next, then you presume that there's a plan, right? And I think but seriously, yeah, it sounds like a joke, but I think that that's part of the problem here, is that we're standing around trying to analyze something from a sort of logical, rationalized perspective, and it doesn't seem like this administration is really run by those forces. You know, it's run by a man who acts on instinct. He totally disregards his institutions. He's set aside a lot of his advisors in the National Security Council and in the State Department. So it's really hard to sort of gauge what the next step is from sort of rational parameters. What he's gotten already is a promise to get 50 million barrels of oil, the Wall Street Journal just reported. So I guess he's gotten something out of this. He's also...
It hasn't been confirmed by the Venezuelans, though.
Well, yeah.
But he's saying that he's saying that they're going to give
him
a lot of
money. So it's true, yeah. Right? That's how this works. And he has Maduro in prison, and he's parading him around, and so he's already gotten something, and he's gotten a sort of he's built the United States reputation and his own reputation as a man of action, as someone who's doing what is actually threatening or promising to do, depending on your view.
Mm. So, I'm thinking about the 50 million barrels of oil, and I'm thinking about Mr. Robinson's telling us that we started out as pirates. So it's sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, another next step, I mean, you are the US correspondent currently for Aftenposten, Kjetil, and normally when we think about Greenland and going to Greenland, it's someone from the Oslo office or the Europe correspondent. But if Trump gets his way, then that might be part of your job
yeah,
to cover
gonna be,
yeah,
Greenland.
I'm going to get to travel through Greenland a lot.
Yeah,
yeah, that's going to be excellent.
But it seems like they've changed tacks now, that they're not going to take it by force anymore. They're going to buy it, just like Trump said, I guess, back in 2019.
Yes, the Secretary of State had a briefing in Congress and said that, well, we're actually not going to invade, we're going to buy it.
Mm.
Which, of course, is contrary to what the boss and Stephen Miller, his advisor, are signaling.
Mm.
But then again, who knows? He said recently that, well, let's wait 20. We have Venezuela now. Let's wait 20 days, and then we can talk about Greenland again. So I guess we're going to. Usually he says, well, let's wait 2 weeks, and now he says 20 days. So I don't know if that's a single or something. Yeah.
But I think it's a credible threat of invasion that might induce the sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's probably it, yeah.
It's a good point.
Yeah, when you have a gun pointed at you, it's difficult to say no. But, I mean, Dr. Robinson, you write a lot about institutions and the need for institutions and how they preserve societies and help create growth. And one thing is sort of at the local or the national level. But when we look at the U.S. foreign policy right now, it's a very clear tearing down of international institutions and norms and what's been called the rules-based society. When we see how quickly things are happening now, how worried are you about this current state of affairs?
Well, I mean, I see a lot of continuities, which was a point I was trying to make in my speech. I see a lot of continuities, actually, between what just happened in Venezuela and the way the United States has already always thought about the world. You know, if you think about the overthrow of the Allende government in 1973, you think about the overthrow of, you know, Mr. Mossadegh's government in Iran in the 1950s, and that was all connected to the nationalization of foreign mining assets, by the way. Think about the invasion of Haiti, the Dominican Republic, the annexation of, you know, Hawaii, Nicaragua was invaded, you know, like, so there's a lot of continuities, and during the Cold War, yeah, there was a rule-based order, but there was also a lot of fairly ambiguous commitment to it. So I actually see more continuity maybe than some.
Mm. So we're looking at the previous period with sort of with tinted glasses on, that we're remembering it differently than what it actually was?
Yeah, I think so.
Hmm.
I think, I mean, during Trump's first administration, you could ask people in NATO or in other governments or even in the American government, people would say that, yeah, underneath all the noise and all the rhetoric, institutions are functioning pretty well. The way that they did before, uh-huh. Like NATO is functioning the way the State Department is functioning, although it's been pared down. I don't know that that's true anymore. I mean, to an extent, I think it's true, but I think that the institutions have been more severely damaged this time around than they were during Trump's first administration. And we're still just a year in.
How do you see that from the ground in Washington, D.C. or around in the U.S.? How do you see that these institutions are now crumbling?
Well, this last year, you could almost feel it crumbling in Washington, D.C. And from the time when they put trash bags over the logo of the USAID building, people are carrying out their belongings from their offices and fired right there and then and there. During the shutdown, I was out in the streets and I talked to this tax lawyer from IRS who was selling hot dogs in the streets. And
wearing a suit.
In a suit, in a red tie, you know, the Trump red tie, so to speak. And the thing is, the most interesting thing was not that he was out there selling hot dogs, but that he was so afraid to say anything that might be construed as criticism of the political administration.
Hmm.
And that's the thing now. The federal employees have always been, have held back But now they're actually afraid.
Mm. Yeah. No, I completely agree about the institutional deterioration. Yes, it's been dramatic compared to the first administration.
Yeah. Mm. And also, I mean, you've talked about, including in an interview in Aftenposten today, about the need for institutions to create innovation. I think you said something like Elon Musk thinks that he's rich because he's such a genius.
Yes.
But he was dependent on institutions in order to gain that wealth and to get that that power.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, he is a genius in his own way. He's a brilliant man. You know, he's a brilliant entrepreneur. But his wealth is completely conditional on the nature of the institutions. You know, if you put him in Congo, he couldn't create all that wealth in Congo because he wouldn't be able to write enforceable contracts. There wouldn't be educated people for him to hire. He wouldn't be able to get a proper property right to a piece of land, you know. So his, you know, he's, of course, he's great. He's brilliant. But like that would come to nothing without the institutions. But he seems not to understand that.
Maybe someone should send him to Congo.
Lots of natural resources.
Try it out.
I mean, Christina, you've been thinking a lot about institutional innovation as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find really frustrating at this moment is that Europe is sort of buying into the narrative that Americans and the Trump MAGA movement is foisting upon them, right? So they're constantly saying that Europe is in crisis, that it's being destroyed, that the population is being replaced, that there is no economic growth, no innovation, no nothing. And I think narratives can become they can become truth if someone isn't speaking against it. And I think that's, from what I've heard today, that's what a lot of you are talking about, that Europe needs to do a lot more with innovation and technology and regulation. But we also need to take back the narrative about who we are and what we actually do and the values that we have here. And it's making me pretty angry that other people are allowed to define us in a way that is just not true.
Yes.
And I think if we act on that falsehood, then that is to our detriment. So I think this is a moment that we also have to be really aware that the narrative is driving a lot of the action here. It's not just the facts on the ground.
Yeah, but one thing is narrative, another thing is numbers and facts on the ground. And it is a fact that innovation has been slowing down in much of Europe and that growth has been slower than, for example, in the US, at least in the last couple of years. Dr. Robinson, do you think that these strong institutions that we have in Europe, maybe especially in Scandinavia, that they might be standing in the way of innovation, that they might be too restrictive?
You know, I completely agree with this business about the narrative. You know, that was a, you know, I think that, you know, I think if I thought about the United States, the reason that these narratives can get so much traction is because of the underlying problems, because of the underlying polarization, because of, you know, this enormous increase in inequality over the past 40 or 50 years, you know, because of collapsing trust in institutions. And I think here, Europe has huge advantages. You know, you have social insurance. You know, people who lose their jobs get help. You know, they're not meant to feel like losers. You know, they're meant, you know, so you have far more mechanisms, you know, which has stopped inequality rising so much, which has kind of put a brake on this type of polarization. You have different political systems. You know, you have proportional representation political systems, which gives much more voice, you know, than this American system does. So I think your underlying structures are much better. They're much more resilient, you know, so it's more difficult for these very kind of perverse narratives to gain traction. But you're right that they also become self-fulfilling. And I think taking back the narrative, that's exactly the right way to think about it. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I think, look at what Europe has done since the last crisis. They put a lot of money into infrastructure. They've put a lot of money into actually small and medium-sized businesses. If you look at a country like Spain or Greece, they're doing pretty well compared to where they were 10, 15 years ago. And we're not, I mean, I think it's partly also our fault in the media, but it should be everybody's business now to talk about this and to be more aware of it. And to an extent, I also think that this is actually a language issue, because experts from English-speaking experts, no offense, they dominate so much. The Anglo-American expertise in academia and writers dominate also European discourse. So we really need to rethink all of this and be more aware of it.
Mm. But it's also, I mean, to encourage growth and prosperity and stability, we need collaboration between nations as well and across the Atlantic Sea. And Seattle, when you travel around the U.S., do you see a difference in how you're treated as a European now that the geopolitical landscape has changed? I mean, well, I know they have difficulties pronouncing your name. Seattle is difficult in English. That's why they call you Mr. Handsome instead of Hansen.
Well, they do. But it's... But you say you're Norwegian, it's usually not a problem. Everybody, for some reason, they love Norwegians. So at least definitely in the Midwest, they do. And when you talk to them, the MAGA crowd, they're pretty soon to say, well, we're not going to send all our money abroad. We're going to stop doing that. The president is doing a great job, not sending all our money, sending all our soldiers abroad. The America First movement is quite strong in his base.
Hmm.
That's definitely the impression I get out there.
So it's still good to be Norwegian.
It's always good to be Norwegian. Yes.
But on the other side of collaboration, you have competitiveness and the big, great power rivalry between the U.S. and China. And I know you've written extensively about China, Dr. Robinson, and you have said previously that you don't think that their current model can sustain itself because of its political structure. It can't sustain its economic growth. It still seems to be going strong, China. I mean, and now with the tariff war and with Trump's policies, China seems to be doing quite well, even without democracy.
Yeah, you know, my view is that it's very simple. Its power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think, you know, you could tell stories about Chinese uniqueness or, you know, well, but I think if you look at China's own history, you see that. You only have to go back to the 1960s and 1970s to see that, you know. So I just think like there's no precedent, you know, for having a really dynamic, innovative, entrepreneurial society with a totalitarian political system. I just don't think you can square that circle. I think the success of China was entirely due to, you know, allowing the market to flourish, allowing people to do their thing, allowing innovation, kind of withdrawing the state from controlling every aspect of people's lives. But you can only sustain that for so long with that type of political system. I think, you know, in our book, we show in Why Nations Fail, we show there's many examples in history of what we call extractive growth, you know, but it's always transitory. There's lots of different mechanisms that make it transitory. But I think, you know, for me, the big one is absolute power corrupts absolutely. What you see now is a consolidation of a personalistic dictatorship, basically. You know, school children have to learn of the great thoughts of President Xi, and that's only going to end badly.
How much time would you give it?
Social science doesn't make predictions like that.
But I mean, there is a danger to, I mean, say that it continues to last for his lifetime. And I mean, he's about 70 years old. He can live for a number of years.
250, I thought.
He said he's going to live forever. And Christina, I mean, that means if they manage to continue with this model and the U.S. keeps withdrawing from world markets and from multilateral institutions, we might have a very different world order in 10 years than what we have today.
Mm. I mean, I think it's already happening. And I think that the U.S. is sort of helping China out a lot by withdrawing from energy transition, scrapping all of Biden's initiatives when it comes to innovation and developing electric vehicles. I mean, just before the weekend, it was announced that BYD, the Chinese car brand, is now bigger than Tesla. So Americans had a great company. I mean, they still have Tesla, but they had the opportunity 10 years ago to take this market, to dominate this market, and they just gave it up. For what? So I think that, you know, it's a paradox, but I think that the way that Trump is running America now, he's actually helping China out a lot, and they would have been in a much worse place if America had been more aggressive and put their money and their talents to this transition. That they should have done it, and they haven't, and now they're backtracking.
But still, you know, 40 years ago, we all thought Japan was going to rule the world in the future. And if Dr. Robinson is right, maybe China is not.
Mm. We're starting to see the end signal for our podcast here. But I just want to touch briefly on the coming year now. Seattle, you'll be covering extensively the run-up to the midterm elections. Where are you going to start? I mean, what are you most interested in looking at right now in order to try to gain an understanding of where the United States is right now?
Well, what everybody's on the Democratic side, at least, are worried about now is how much will the administration try to influence the elections and the election process. And we all seen it in Texas and California and Missouri. We saw the Senate in Indiana stopped. They were trying to do some gerrymandering there to get more Republican seats. And this is just a run-up. And then comes all the other the questions of voter IDs and such. And I think that's where we're going to have to start, because if the midterms were tomorrow, it would probably be a landslide for the Democrats. But, you know, it's still 10 months to go, and it might not be that way.
Mm. Let me end with you, Dr. Robinson. When you write about failed states and how states are dependent on institutions, and then we see institutions being torn down in the United States, do you think the state can outlive Donald Trump? Can it survive Donald Trump? Or is the U.S. in a danger of becoming a failed state?
I think it takes a long time for these things to show up. You know, we're in the middle of this enormous boom in AI and there's a lot of momentum behind that. I think that's going to have big effects on productivity. But like the big picture, if we stay on this track in the United States the United States is not going to be the world economic leader in 10 years time or 20 years time. The institutional erosion of the rule of law, of the state, of the capacity of the state, this kind of completely dysfunctional foreign policy, you know, like that's going to impoverish the United States, this antipathy, you know. I mean, one of the big sources, one of the big mechanisms behind the economic success of the institutions in the United States has been this ability to suck talent out of the rest of the world. You know, if you read the Draghi report, you know, how many startups, you know, begin in Europe and then move to the United States because of capital markets, because of, you know, that's going to go into reverse. All that will go into reverse. And that will be a tipping point for the United States economically.
Final word, Christina.
Yeah. This reminds me of, I'm reading a book about the Renaissance and why the Renaissance happened. And the author says you have to have three things. You have to have wealth, you have to have talent, and you have to have freedom. And only if those three things exist can you get this kind of expansion, this kind of innovation. And I think that's very true also for America.
And on that note, I would like to say thank you very much to James Robinson. Tusen takk, Christina Pletten, Kjetil Hansen. Jeg heter Kristoffer Rønneberg. Dette har vært en ekstra sending av Aftenpodden USA. Dere kan høre alle episodene våre i Podme og i Aftenposten-appen. Og så heter vår ansvarlige redaktør Trine Eilertsen. Tusen takk for oss. Thank you very much.